Welcome to In, a series of live online conversations with practitioners in the visual arts. In is broadcasted by New Local Space, a micro gallery and contemporary art initiative in Kingston, Jamaica, and a subsidiary of audio production house Creative Sounds. Tonight, we speak with New York-based curator Blair Murphy about her recent curatorial project in the Whitney Museum of American Art Independent Study Program, an exhibition titled SN. SN is short for signal-to-noise ratio. The exhibition featured the work of several sound artists, including the art collectives Scratch and Ultra Red. We'll talk to Blair tonight about the dynamics of the audio and oral as they were incorporated within the SN exhibition, as well as her curatorial history and future projects. Blair holds a BFA from Maryland Institute College of Art, MICA, as well as an MA from Georgetown University. Before moving to New York, she spent 7 years in DC working as an arts administrator for various organizations, including the Washington Project for the Arts, DC Arts Center, DCAC, and Provisions Library. She was also a curator with Sparkplug, an artist collective sponsored by DCAC from 2008 to 2011, and a program director at the WPA from 2011 to 2013. In 2014, she was awarded the Helena Rubinstein Curatorial Fellowship of the Whitney Independent Study Program. Blair, we've been working towards having this interview for quite some time now, and it's great to finally have you with us. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, hi, Deborah. Thanks for having me. It's really great to have a chance to talk with you about what I've been working on and also to talk with all the listeners out there. This is a really great format. It's really nice to be able to have a platform like this where you can bring in listeners from all over and make those connections. I really like how these kinds of programs can kind of expand the different audiences you reach. It's great being here in New York. And like you said before, I was in DC for a few years. And I think one of the things I'm really interested in as a curator, being based here, is making connections to people all over and keeping up with folks I know in DC and just keeping up with things that are happening all over the place, because there's exciting things here, but I know for a fact there's exciting things happening all around. So yeah, it's great to be here, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Awesome, thanks. So we should, for anybody who missed that, we should highlight again that Blair is in New York right now, and our program is based in Jamaica, so we are having transnational conversation right now. So Blair, I want to just get right into it and ask you to tell us a little bit about your curatorial practice and what your focus is now. What direction your practice has taken and when it took this direction, and has this been a focus of yours? I should mention to the audience that I've known Blair for about 4 or 5 years now. We met at the DCAC within the Sparkplug program. And so it's really interesting to see how your practice has developed. So yeah, I'm going to give you a chance to answer the question.
Sure. My practice, I guess, has changed actually a fair amount over the last few years. During my time in DC, I was working primarily with a few different arts nonprofits in the realm of arts administration. I was doing some curatorial work as well, but that was a smaller sort of part of what I was doing. During my time at Washington Project for the Arts, I was the program director, which was a really great opportunity because I worked with a lot of the independent curators they had that they would bring in for group exhibitions. And so I learned a lot in that position, just as far as organizing exhibitions and working with artists and doing the kind of logistics of it. That was just all really valuable knowledge to build up and great experience working with the people they had. Who they brought in as curators. I didn't have as much time to do my own curatorial projects at that point. So since moving to New York a couple years ago, that's been a little bit more of a focus of mine. As you mentioned in the introduction, I participated in the Whitney Museum's Independent Study Program starting in September of 2014 up through June of 2015. So it's a 1 year program it's like the school year. So that was, really my main focus for that period of time. And then since then, I guess what I'm working on right now, I've been have begun working with a space called Field Projects, which is an artist-run project space up here in New York that was founded by artists Jacob Rhodes and Carrie Oldham, who are both New York-based. And that's been a great opportunity and really valuable opportunity to work with those guys. I curated a show that was up at Field Projects in September and October called Marginalias, which I think actually included Wilmer Wilson IV, who I think is an NLS residency alumni.
Yes.
And then I'm working right now on a project, another project with Field Projects, which will be an installation at Artist Run, which is a show being organized by Tiger Strikes Asteroid in Miami during Miami Art Basel Week.
Okay. Tiger Strikes Asteroid is based in Philly, right?
They're actually, they have, there's sort of a network of artist-run spaces. So there's one in Philly, and I think it was started in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. There's also one here in Brooklyn, and then there's another Tiger Strikes Asteroid space in Los Angeles.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and they're organizing this project for Miami Art Week, called Artist Run, which is going to be in an old hotel, and each hotel room will have an installation that's being organized by a different artist-run space.
Okay, I want to ask you. I want to find out more about what those projects are like, but I guess before, I mean, because you said that your curatorial practice really started to take some more focus or get some more focus once you moved to New York. So I want to really start the conversation off with the first of those projects, which is the SN exhibition, right? That was part of the Whitney ISP.
Sure.
So you were one of three curators of that exhibition, right?
I was, yeah. That since that exhibition happened as part of my participation in the Whitney ISP, the format of the program is that there's a each year there's about 25 people who participate. There's a studio track, which is about 15 people, a critical writing track, which is usually six people, and they're usually scholars or art historians who are doing scholarly projects. And then there's the curatorial track, which is the smallest. Typically it's four people. My year it was actually three. But it started in, like I said, September, and then the exhibition opened in May. So the format of the program is that the curators work together to co-curate an exhibition. So they start planning in September, and then the exhibition opens in May. So SN was the exhibition that we curated as part of that.
How did it come about? Like, how did the signal to noise ratio concept develop between the three curators?
Well, it's a bit of a challenge because they bring you together, and they do try to select people a little bit who they think will work well together and have shared interests. But you meet in September and then have to conceptualize and organize a show, which, you know, I guess the closest comparison for a visual artist would be if you know, were introduced and then had to collaborate on work. So it's a little bit of a challenge. I think the sound, the idea of working with sound emerged partly because all three of us had an interest in experimenting with the typical exhibition format. The program runs every year, and there's a, you know, typically the exhibition that you organize is usually a large group exhibition that's kind of thematically connected. There's some kind of, you know, strong thematic element that brings all the work together. And so we started the conversation early in the year about ways to, you know, destabilize a little bit or play a little bit with the format that the show had always taken. And eventually, between the three of us, I think we had interest in performance and sound and video, kind of all, you know, all of us bringing in different elements of what we were interested in. And I think we started to get interested in sound just because it seemed like something that we could do and kind of play with the exhibition format. And and it was a little, you know, we all had a little bit of an interest in it in some experience, but it was also something that was new to all of us. Also, none of us came in with a really strong, you know, really strong background in sound art or anything like that. So it was also neutral ground in a way, which I think was good. We all kind of, you know, it was a little bit new for all of us.
Yeah, who are the other curators? Leading artists.
Yeah, so the other curators were Alex Fleming, who's a New York-based artist and curator, and Anya Kumar, who's another New York-based curator. That was actually unusual. Typically, with the program, there are a number of people, usually most years, who come from either other parts of the United States or other parts of the world to participate. So it was actually somewhat out of the ordinary for all three of the curators to have already been in New York. I know this year there's, I think, one American curator, and then the other three curators are all from different, I believe, different European countries. I could be getting that wrong, but they all moved to the city just for the program. So,
awesome.
And the artists in the show, it was a fairly large exhibition. We actually had 14 artists, but because of the format, kind of, you know, the work happening in, it wasn't all objects in the actual gallery space. So we had video work by Sonia Boyce and Ayn Bailey, a collaborative work by those artists who are all, who are two British artists, and then a video by Manon DeBoer, a video work that was actually a documentation of a performance by the artist Joan LaBarbera, additional video work by Steve Ranke and Liz Rhodes, who is a, Liz Rhodes is another British artist who's a, fairly well known for her video work, actually film work, I'm sorry, I should say film, started off as a structuralist filmmaker and then moved more into making work that explored feminist themes. There was also a video work by Masha Tupitsin, who's a writer and film critic, and also Jackie Wang, who's a poet and is in a PhD program at Harvard, and a writer and theorist and activist. There were audio pieces in the show by the poet Tracy Morris, and then also Vanessa Place, who's a writer and poet and performance artist. Then a video installation by Camissa Bauerhaus, who's a young New York artist who is a performer, does some acting work and performance. Then in addition to the work that was shown in the gallery, there were a few performances as part of the show. So we opened the exhibition with a performance of Piano Sonata No. 6 by the Soviet composer Galina Istvolskaya. And we had Cheryl Seltzer of Continuum Ensemble, which is a New York-based musical ensemble. Cheryl was kind enough to come and perform at the opening. We also had a performance by the audio duo Scratch, which is a young audio duo based in Philadelphia, and then a workshop with the artist activist collective Ultra Red. And then the final work in the show is work by James Coleman, who's an Irish artist, and his contribution was actually included in the catalog. So I realized that was a long list of people with a lot of explanations, but the work sort of, we had a lot of people in the show who weren't necessarily traditionally, you know, just visual artists, you know, people who are poets or do film or video or performance or music. So yeah, it took on a lot of different, kind of happened across a few different platforms, special events, and then the exhibition, and then the contribution in the catalog. And so it was, you know, 14 artists total, which is a lot, but sort of spread out in that way.
And then it's that multidisciplinary approach or artists that work between these lines seems to be really apt for the space where the exhibition was presented, which is the kitchen, right? Because the kitchen is I mean, that's part of the foundation of that particular art space in New York, right? It's a very multidisciplinary space.
Yeah, it was really great to be able to work with the kitchen and do the exhibition there. They have a really, really long history, long rich history of presenting performance, especially here in New York. And their physical space is actually, there's a theater on the ground floor, and then the gallery is on the second floor. So we used the opening night, the piano performance that took place was in the theater, and then the rest of the exhibition that happened on site took place in the gallery. But even their gallery space is set up to be, it's basically a large, the main gallery space is basically a large black box with white gallery walls kind of built in.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually worked out really well, because what we wound up doing with a lot of the video work was actually using the main gallery space to present several video and audio pieces in sequence. So we had three projectors set up, each projecting on a separate wall, and then a single work played at a time. And the videos, you know, at one point there would be a video on one wall from a projector, and then once that ended, a different video would start on a different wall from a different projector. And even being able to have, you know, having the technical capability of doing that was just great. And I think it's not necessarily something that we could have done, you know, with a lot of organizations, but because they do have such an interdisciplinary focus and, you know, the whole theater setup, and you know such experience with performance and working in these different media that we were able to have the technical capability of doing that, which was really great. And that was it was just a really nice way of showing off the video work and the audio work as well. Piece we had in the show by the poet Tracy Morris was an audio recording of her performing a piece, and it came on in the main gallery. And at that point, just all of the screen, the projectors were all off, and you just heard her her piece, which is just really powerful.
I see. I think I'm going to I'm going to take the list of the artists that were in the show and tag the YouTube video with them. So that if there's anybody who wants to be more clear on which are on the artists that were actually in, they can just go there and find out. I'd also be great if we could publish that, put that essay, a link to the essay. But I want to, because I was reading it and the following passage stood out for me in the essay that you wrote, and your essay was titled Call and Response. And it accompanied to accompany the exhibition. I'm going to read a shortish passage from it and then ask you a few questions about it because it really piqued my interest. So I'm going to start now. While speaking is often associated with authority, and again, this really focuses on, as you said, the oral and just the on the oral aspect of this exhibition more than the video aspect. While speaking is often associated with authority, knowledge, and certainty, listening is frequently assumed to be disengaged, inactive, and even subservient. Even an attentive listener, described as receptive, engrossed, or absorbed, is imagined as an emptiness to be filled or a substance to be consumed. In some cases, the vulnerability of listeners is turned against them, as in the use of extended exposure to loud music as a form of torture, or the deployment of sound cannons to disperse protesters. But listening is not, or not only, passive. Listening, and the more obviously fraught condition of being spoken to, involves action, even though this action may not always be visible or audible. So SN examines listening really intently, which to some might seem at odds with the notion of an exhibition. So I was wondering if you could give us some idea about the form the exhibition took. I mean, you already gave us a bit by even describing the physical space of the kitchen, but maybe more about the exhibition design and the concept.
I'm sure. Well, as I mentioned, we really started off the year with a conversation about you know, ways to possibly experiment with the exhibition format. And I think that is one reason why we wound up moving towards the idea of sound. The focus of my essay in particular on listening was kind of part of the broader perspective of the whole show. So I think, you know, that focus relates to a few specific artists and was definitely something we all had in mind. To a certain extent, of course, I mean, listening is the counterpoint to sound. So those sort of ideas can't really be delinked. But as I mentioned, in talking about the exhibition, I think I tend to discuss the video pieces and the installation of those in the room. And in some ways, that maybe is a little misleading in terms of the focus. I think, yeah, exploring sound in the context of the gallery space was a little bit of a challenge just because it is an experience that people expect to have that will be visual. And so in some ways, by putting the visual and the aural on equal terms, you're already, you know, even if it's just equal terms, you're already emphasizing listening more than often happens. It also brought up just a lot of really kind of maybe, you know, boring to some people, logistical issues in terms of presenting sound in a space that isn't necessarily designed for it. A lot of the ways we think about exhibition design are so much about you know, how to separate the work visually, so giving things enough space on the wall, you know, giving videos enough room, having an environment where people can sit down and experience a video. And once you really get into having a show that's, you know, almost, you know, everything in the gallery has some kind of audio element, you have a whole other layer of challenges just in terms of keeping the audio isolated enough. So in terms of the design of the show, that was something that we kind of bumped up against, you know, pretty early on, and that we always knew was going to be kind of a problem. As part of the program, we, you know, had meetings throughout the year with, you know, some curators from the museum and just some other outside people to get feedback. And that was definitely something that came up early on, was just having to worry about. It gives you this other added element that you have to worry about. And it's the idea of sound, and then also the temporal aspect, of course, too. Even with the idea of, in some ways, the solution that we came up with to deal with the sound issue introduced a new issue of time that we, you know, also kind of bumped up against. The installation in the main gallery, obviously having the works sequenced so they played one at a time, was kind of an easy solution. Well, not an easy solution, but, you know, partly that idea came up as a solution to the sound issues that we would have faced if we had, mm-hmm. you know, 6 or 7 videos playing in a room. We didn't just want to have a bank of TVs with all with headphones. But then, of course, by having all the work played back to back, it meant that if someone wanted to experience the entire show, they had to be there for, I think it was around an hour, I think, if you added up the time. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was longer because there was one longer piece, the Manon Dibor video that was in the exhibition. Or actually, that's also a film, sorry. The Manon Dibor film that was in the exhibition was about 40 minutes long. So it was a significant time commitment to come in and experience the entire exhibition. And I think that was something that we had a few conversations about and kind of decided that, you know, this is the best way to present the work. Some people, you know, there may have been some visitors who were really resistant to it and who kind of showed up and thought, I can't do this. I'm not going to see him. You know, I can only see a third of the show. But I think that was kind of the trade-off that we had to make, that we felt we had to make to present the work in a way that we were happy with. And we got, you know, a range of feedback. I've had a couple people tell me how great they thought it was and how they, you know, people would show up some days and like actually sit through the whole, would be there through the entire run of everything that happened in the main gallery space. That loop was about an hour, I think, if you were going to be there for the whole thing. So, you know, people would come in and really be there for the whole thing. And then other people would come in and leave pretty quickly. And, you know, I think that's the, a trick with audio work and also video and film work, just in general, showing it in the gallery space, as you know, it takes a certain level of commitment and,
it's obviously time-based, and I mean, some could argue that a painting can unfold in certain ways over time, but mm-hmm. when you know, you're dealing with something like video and audio, it's like very obviously time-based. But I think one hour commitment to seeing an exhibition, yeah, I think that's a really good time to absorb the work.
Mm-hmm.
You also, in your essay, you also recall Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Masks. The call, a Negro, shouted by a white Frenchman to his mother, Tinique, author in Paris, represents the moment when the colonized is fixed as other by the gaze of the colonizer. The fact that the subject relies on an external, sometimes oppressive power for its beginning and continued social existence, in Fanon's case, French society has positioned him as a racially other, colonized subject, poses a challenge for political discourses that attempt to alter those existing systems of power, such as the liberation movement that sought to end colonialism. A question on the perceived state of affairs emerges to me from this passage. Even if there is a dissatisfaction, the above passage assumes that there is a mutual agreement on this particular power dynamic that extends beyond the social structure to deriving one's existence, at least in part, from being regarded, right? So it's the act of being regarded. What are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts on this? Are there works in the exhibition that challenge the passage that I just read? And is the term subject, quote unquote, an accurate representation of how we deal with power in our current moment in society?
So for that particular passage, and really I think most of my essay, especially the earlier parts that deal a little more with the theoretical framework, I was relying pretty heavily on particular theoretical work that sort of tries to explain the formation of the self or the emergence of subjectivity in terms of the relationship with power structures and the idea that you somehow, your understanding of yourself is inextricably linked to this relationship with other people who are outside of you. So it's the other in some kind of abstract sense, or, you know, more specifically in the Fanon passage, the other as, you know, a sort of more politicized other who takes on, you know, very specific connotations in terms of the relationship between the colonized subject and the colonizer. So it's definitely a really a particular you know theoretical perspective, and I was looking a lot at the French theorist Louis Althusser, and then also some work by the theorist Judith Butler, especially the Butler I rely on pretty heavily, and I think her writing, especially from her book The Psychic Life of Power, she's invested you know pretty heavily in retaining this idea of the fixed self. And sees it as kind of central to a political project, like the possibility of political change. She sees this kind of unified some sort of contingent, at least, you know, self as a necessary precursor to social change taking place. I think there are definitely other schools of thought that would disagree, both with the idea that you know, we can only understand ourselves through this relationship with another person outside of us, or other people outside of us, or other schools of thought that take issue with the necessity of kind of holding on to that idea of the subject as the focus in a way. Like Deleuze and Guattari come to mind in terms of, you know, letting go of this idea of the coherent subject is important to conversations about political change. So I think those you know schools of thought are definitely out there. I've always been attracted to Butler's writing on the topic, especially just because she does walk this line of acknowledging,
yeah,
the sort of complexities of that of identity and of how it develops, while also wanting to retain some kind of idea of coherent identity as an agent of you know of change and social change in the world. But yeah, so I think that's in some ways there are definitely other ways to interpret that. Especially, I think right now, even the focus on the subject is the primary focus of politics is you know for our current moment, especially. I think whether or not that is the best way to approach it is a complicated question.
It is a complicated question. You mentioned, I mean, I highlighted another part in your essay that actually specifically references Judith Butler's The Psychic Life of Power. I'm going to read it. Inaugurated through power, the subject also emerges through this founding as a site where power can be reiterated and thus altered. Power persists through reiteration, through repetitions that are carried out by the very subjects inaugurated by power. In this reiteration, Butler locates both the continuation of power and the possibility for agency. So I guess that really alludes to the complexity that you just mentioned, which is that yes, okay, well, in that being regarded or in that listening, and I guess in the context of this particular exhibition, in the act of listening, then one has the opportunity to, as you say, engage how they're being regarded and react to that in particular ways, in different ways. But do you see SN as an exploration into the possibility of different ways of listening and listening as a potential tool for rebellion, subversion, and or agency? Are there works in the exhibition that do this especially?
So I think there yeah, I think, you know, as I in the essay later talk a little bit about the Ultra, the artist activist collective Ultra Red, who I was really excited to get to work with because they're a group whose work I've been following for a long time. I think they're, you know, committed to a really particular, well, I shouldn't say particular actually, because they work on a really wide range of issues, but as a group, they have a commitment to using, I think, specific kind of aesthetic tools in order to organize communities who are working on different issues. So the group's been around since the early 1990s and originally started out working on needle exchange programs and sort of issues around HIV and AIDS. And then since then, the group has grown, and right now it's, I think, a collective of about 10 people who are based all over the world, and they've worked on, tend to work in a way that's very project-based, so they work for a long time on specific issues and work really closely with community groups, really sort of as part of those groups. I'm really interested in their practice. They're definitely a group that can be challenging to include in an exhibition, just because they're, if we want to get back to the idea of work being time-based, you know, the span in which they work is sort of, you know, based on years and at this point decades. But I think in some ways they are, you know, come to mind first if we were going to talk about a group that thinks about listening as a potential tool for rebellion and subversion and also agency. They started out more as a group that created sound pieces, and then in the last few years they've begun exploring listening more as a political tool and as this kind of tool for building relationships amongst people who are working together to organize for change. So on issues like homelessness and public housing and anti-racism and education also, like I said, they have about 10 members. So in some ways it's a collective of people who use these tools and then kind of bring them to particular struggles that they're interested in particular. But they're really heavily influenced by the work of the political theorist Susan Bickford, who talks a lot about the importance of the relationship of listener and speaker in a democratic context and kind of how you can use that dynamic in order to promote promote dialogue. So they really have explored listening and developing these particular practices of listening that draw on Bickford's work in order to create, they talk a lot about intersubjectivity and I think to sort of create understanding in, you know, within groups of people through these very structured listening practices. So I think they're, you know, in terms of, I think they're the prime example in the show of really thinking of listening as a possible tool.
I'm going to ask you some more about, you said they use a very structured mm-hmm. approach. I'm going to ask you some more about that later, but you know, the whole mentioning listening as an act of and listening as a way forward with agency can sound esoteric and sound a bit abstract for a wide audience. So I want to get a little bit more specific. The word listening and the title of the project, Call and Response, seems to be pretty benign culturally. I mean, when we're talking about listening, we think about it in just the just a very general way. So it seems pretty benign culturally. Mm-hmm. And the weight of words might come across as really light. And they are also rather universal. It's a really universal word. But how did the connection with post-colonial racial discourse emerge for you with this project and the connection between that and listening?
Mm-hmm, sure. The connection to Fanon specifically partly relates to the structure of the program itself, the independent study program. Besides the process of organizing the exhibition, myself and the two other curators were also participating all year in twice weekly seminars. They have a pretty wide range of critics and art historians and theorists and artists who come in and give these seminars twice a week, as well as some seminars that happen at the beginning of the year with Ron Clark, who's the director of the program. So Fanon is someone who we discussed during the seminars who came up in that context, both as a figure in his own right, and then also Isaac Julian is an artist that visits the program. So we also had a conversation about his film work, his film Black Skin White Masks, that engages with Fanon. So I think that that connection exists in this way that isn't entirely clear from the exhibition itself, and I think came up for me because of the conversations that were happening in the seminars. Ron Hart Clark, who's the head of the program, is also especially interested in the work of Stuart Hall. So the connection with writing around post-colonial issues was present in that way as well. And I think the conversation around, in some ways I can see how the more abstract conversation about power dynamics is a little sort of, in a lot of cases, becomes very abstract in the essay. As far as work in the exhibition, I think, Tracy Morris's poetry piece that was in the show, it doesn't deal specifically with the post-colonial. It was a work called The Mrs. Gets Her Ass Kicked. As I mentioned, she's a poet and a performance artist, and so the piece is a work where she begins reciting singing / reciting the lyrics from the Irving Berlin classic Cheek to Cheek, and then slowly kind of starts beating on her chest until the vocals and her expression kind of becomes difficult to understand. There's a sort of, I think, terrifying violence to it in a way that she's kind of inflicting on herself as this sort of breaks down what you can and can't understand. So her work, I think, in terms of the, draws more on her connections to her own experience. And I think that's, I'm going to back up a little bit. She talks about the Mrs. Gets Her Ass Kicked, in the context of taking this white classic and really breaking it down in a way that's almost kind of violent and breaking down her own subjectivity. It relates a little more towards the Black American experience. Mm-hmm. So that's not a direct connection to the Fanon, but as I mentioned, but
the intersubjectivity, I want to get into that. You mentioned, we had a little exchange a few minutes ago about, as you said, with Fanon and his mentioning of the moment where this, the Martinican is regarded by as a Negro, the Negro. What exactly, and I mentioned, is it appropriate now in these times to really be able to really derive one's identity or have an idea of oneself based on how one is regarded or how one listens to other actually or listens to another regarding you? So you mentioned intersubjectivity. Mm-hmm. Can you talk, what is intersubjectivity? I want this to be as accessible. I know that we're getting, we are pretty technical and we're really in it, but I do want some access points for people, a larger audience.
Sure. So maybe
you talk a little bit about what intersubjectivity means. And then after that, I'd love to find out, I'm really curious to find out what these five protocols for organizing that you said Ultra Red has devised.
Sure. Yeah. I think as far as the conversation about whether it's still appropriate to derive one's identity from an outside source, I think it's less a sort of question of if it's appropriate in our times than a question of is there an alternative? Is there a way to kind of understand yourself that's not somehow based on responses that you're getting from the outside world, which, I mean, obviously the Fanon example is a very stark example in terms of, understanding yourself through this power structure that's essentially, that exists to kind of dehumanize you. That's a very particular extreme example. And it's not to suggest that there's no alternative to that specifically, but more this idea that the way we understand who we are is caught up in the responses that we get from the outside world, and that can take many forms, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of intersubjectivity, it's a phrase that I think is used to sort of refer to the relationship that I think Ultra Red is sort of attempting to create, that they can create this relationship between people that becomes where they can really listen to and understand one another, I think is maybe the easiest way to put it. So they can, one of the protocols that they often do, or you know, that they sort of repeat, is actually a protocol where it's not so much that someone speaks and another person listens, but actually that you have multiple people and they all listen to the same thing. So they walk through a space together and they listen to the space, what's happening in the space, or they, in some cases, the group will have recordings that they'll play. And so, you know, a group of five or six people will listen to the recording and then they discuss what they heard. And so the idea of intersubjectivity is kind of this idea of how, by having this shared experience of listening together to this sound and then exchanging ideas about what they thought that sound meant, or, you know, what that sound meant to them, they can come to this understanding between the people. So in a sort of day-to-day experience, you know, we each have our own experience of the world, and it's can be almost impossible to kind of understand what another person's experience is like exactly. So I think the concept of intersubjectivity is based on this idea of having a shared experience and then working through how to understand that experience together and how to make sense of it, two people or three people or a small group. Does that help clarify a little bit?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
So what in Ultra Red's installation, what are people listening to when they walk mm-hmm. through space? What are Ultra Red's five protocols for mm-hmm. organizing? So I mean, you basically gave. I am presuming that part of what you just said was part of the protocol, but what are they listening to? What mm-hmm. what would one be listening mm-hmm. to when they walk through the space?
Mm-hmm. So as part of the show, there were two works really that were part of their participation. One of the pieces was included as a photocopy on paper, like they might have used in a workshop, and that was installed in the space. And it was a piece called The Protocols for the Wanarovich Object. And that particular protocol was originally created for an exhibition at Fales Library at New York University. Fales has an extensive archive related to the history of visual art in New York, especially the 1970s and 1980s. And the artist David Wanarovich's papers are part of that archive. So there's a particular document in that archive that's a text Wanarovich wrote on an old customs declaration where he talks about the scene that emerged on the abandoned piers on the west side of Manhattan in the 70s and early 80s. The piers that are on New York's west side were, I think, mostly fallen into disuse by the late 60s, but were still there. There were still buildings and these pier spaces. And so they were a site for a lot of artistic experimentation and also an epicenter of queer culture in New York. So cruising and gay sex, public sex, the sort of culture of that existed on the piers alongside this artistic experimentation. If anyone's familiar with the work of Gordon Matta Clark, there's a few pieces he did that are some of his more well-known works that were done in these abandoned buildings on the West Side piers. So Wanarovich's text focuses on that site as a space of creativity and artistic production and the kind of community that he saw developing, or really multiple communities that were developing in that space and interacting with each other. In the sort of way they resisted being institutionalized. And in terms of the artwork that was being created, really resisted the art market and the logic of commercialization. So for the protocols for the Wanarovich object, the object itself is this text that David Wanarovich wrote. And the idea of the protocol is that you sit around a table, you're supposed to leave a chair for David Wanarovich, and then someone reads the text or there's a recording of the text. And then everyone responds to what they've just heard. So the listening object that everyone listens to would be either the spoken or the recorded version of this text. That actually, including that work in the show, you know, made a lot of sense, particularly because, as we talked about, the exhibition was at the Kitchen, which is on the west side of Manhattan, a little ways north of the kind of space that Wanarovich was talking about. But of course, it's, you know, one of the many spaces in New York that's really changed over the last couple of decades. So I UltraRed, you know, when I met with Robert Simber from UltraRed about participating in the show, he was really excited about the idea of including that work in particular because it relates to the history of the space and kind of the a lot of the conversation in the workshop that happened sort of revolved around the changes. And so for the actual workshop, the first exercise that we did was actually an exercise where we split up into small groups and then walked around the space actually in a line, and whoever was at the front of the line got to lead and was in the line for, led the group for a particular number of minutes, I think. And then once their time was up, they went to the back of the line. And so we really just walked around the neighborhood in silence, just listening. It was on a Saturday afternoon. So, you know, there was traffic and people, and we walked down to the waterfront area. So you heard kind of all the sounds of, the waterfront and all of that, and kind of tourists and, you know, everything that's there now, which is very different from what it would have been like back in the 70s. So with that particular exercise, we went out and listened together and then came back to the space, and then each group, you know, started, reported back sort of on what they'd heard and also compared. It was interesting to hear like what other people who you've been walking with had heard that you hadn't noticed, and kind of rethinking your experience through the lens of the things that other people had heard.
Mm-hmm. Going back to what you mentioned regarding the traditional power dynamics between the listener and the speaker and applying them to one of the artists in the show, Vanessa Place, her piece Last Words, in which she recites the last words spoken by prisoners executed in the state of Texas, words which Place retrieved from the website of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, the traditional power relationship of listener and speaker and how they are brokered seem more unclear and complex in this particular piece, based on, you know, this pretext that were set. What are the implications of this piece, and how did it help shape SN?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say definitely that work has a really different dynamic than the UltraRed work. I think UltraRed's is a very, as I mentioned before, they're very project-driven and have a really specific political commitment. And I think a certain element of realism, but also optimism in a certain way. And, you know, Place's work definitely has a very different different feel. And definitely, I think that work specifically is less, definitely more ambivalent and a little harder to work through. As you mentioned, the piece consists of her reading the last words spoken by every individual that the state of Texas has executed since 1982. And she actually does get the statements from the website where they have a public archive of them. She also includes a few seconds of silence for anyone who declined to make a statement before their execution, which has happened in a few cases. When the work is installed, the audio is actually played out of sync from multiple speakers. So for SN, we installed it in the first floor elevator vestibule and then in the stairway. So as you moved up the stairs, you heard sort of one recording and then another, and then at points they kind of intermingled with one another and kind of became, sort of moved in and out of audibility. One of the issues with that piece that I was specifically interested in, I guess, was this, the notion that she's getting these words from the very, a platform that's, you know, that is that's maintained by the very state that has acted out the executions. Mm-hmm. So she, you know, in some ways is remembering and speaking for these people, but on the other hand, the platform through which they spoke was provided by the very state that was then putting them to death. So that kind of ambivalence and sort of troubling scenario of, like, you know, is this a way of remembering them and speaking for them, or is this, you know, is there a way to do that without, you know, there's not really a way to do that without considering the platform on which it was happening. So yeah, I think that piece in particular is a little, was tricky to deal with as well. Like I've mentioned in some of our earlier conversations, it's, you know, the show just happened in May or June, and it's already feels in some ways to me like it was so long ago. And, you know, it's good in a way to go back and work through it and think about how my perspective of it on it has changed. So Last Words is sort of a different piece from Place's practice in a lot of ways. It's one of the first sound pieces she's done. She's known more for writing and performance, and especially pretty sort of intentionally confrontational and provocative performance works. She has a performance piece called If I Wanted Your Opinion, I'd Remove the Duct Tape, which is a 10-minute recitation of rape jokes.
What was the name of that, Blair?
If I Wanted Your Opinion, I'd Remove the Duct Tape.
Oh, I see.
So that's maybe, it gives a little sense of her practice in a lot of ways being very intentionally provocative.
Yeah.
Which isn't necessarily typically something I am interested in, honestly, in artist's work. So working, one of my co-curators is a frequent collaborator with her, and so her work came up pretty early in our conversations. And it was a little challenging for me as a curator, honestly, because I, you know, a lot of the pieces she's done, I was hesitant to sort of engage with. More recently, she's received a lot of criticism for a piece she did on Twitter where she was tweeting the text of Gone with the Wind, which is a, you know, American novel that's notoriously racist in this sort of text that romanticizes this antebellum South and has a lot of extremely, you know, content that is really offensive and difficult. So she got a lot of pushback about that piece in particular. So she very often works in this way that is in sort of intentionally provocative. Last Words, for me, you know, I was sort of interested in it as a work because it doesn't really operate in quite the same way. It's definitely difficult to listen to and a challenging piece, but in a way it's, you know, I found it to be something that contributed to the broader questions we were discussing as part of the project. And so it felt to me like it made sense to include it in the exhibition and to write about it in the essay. And it's a little challenging for me as a curator because I think, in retrospect, I feel like I, as a curator moving forward, I would like, I think with that work in particular and the way I talked about it, I really discussed it outside of the context of the rest of her practice. And, you know, I think that can be sort of tricky in a way as a curator to really focus on this one work. I'm not trained traditionally as an art historian. I have more of a background in critical theory and cultural studies, and also, you know, in the studio, being trained as a studio artist. So it was, you know, it was an interesting and challenging kind of thing to work through. But in retrospect, I think the thing I learned from it is this sort of weird line you walk in terms of looking at a particular work versus looking at an artist's larger body of work, and can you talk about one without talking about the other? And I think that can, you know, brings up some tricky questions. So that was a, you know, something I'm still thinking about and still working through.
Mm-hmm. I think about Last Words, about Place's piece in the context of this current groundswell of recorded moments of civilian death and violence at the hands of the state. Of course, because her work is taking this, is allowing us this moment of reckoning of these people's, mm-hmm. what these people's words before they're executed by the state. Because of what's happening now and what we've been seeing happening in the, and I mean, it's not just happening now, but what we've been able to listen to and witness now, with these moments of civilian death and violence at the hands of the state, there is a palpable energy of public outrage that we can detect, because we are all able to listen to the voices in the situations that we would not have previously had access to before. Mm-hmm. Do you see this project in conversation with or as a reflection of this moment of public outrage?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something that myself and my co-curators were thinking about and discussing during the year. Being based here in New York, you know, there was a constant conversation happening around the instances of protests that were happening across the U.S., here in New York specifically, the failure to indict the police officer who killed Eric Garner on Staten Island, and then, you know, everything that was happening in Ferguson. You know, obviously these were things that we were all thinking about and talking about. On the other hand, sort of early in the year, as far as our plans for the exhibition, I mean, this would have been September, so at a point when we were really early in our planning, we sort of struggled with this question of doing a really heavily thematic show versus doing something that had a more approached things a little more formally, or a little more, maybe not formally, but that attempted to kind of experiment more with the exhibition form. The expectation with the program is typically that you'll organize a group show, and it, you know, typically does tend to be really heavily thematic. And they've done some, you know, there's some really great exhibitions in the past. That's really a format I'm comfortable working in. But we had some conversations around sort of that, and, you know, wanting to do something that experimented a little more with the format of the exhibition. So I think what we, you know, the final exhibition itself, in some ways, kind of that ambivalence, I think, is probably apparent in some ways. This kind of going back and forth between wanting to do something that responded to what was happening in the moment, versus wanting to do something that explored what was happening in the moment and kind of, you know, didn't seem like it was sort of insular and not responsive, but wanting to do that in a way that experimented formally with the possibilities of what we could do. So there was some work in the show that dealt more explicitly with some of the things that were coming up. There was the piece by Jackie Wang. She's a poet and theorist and activist and writer, and is also currently in a PhD program in African American studies at Harvard, I believe. The work that was included of hers in the show is a video piece called Cybernetic Cop, that's based on a performance she had done before. She's a performance poet, so it's a poem that she had read before, mm-hmm. in performance, sort of multimedia performance. But in the poem, she recounts a RoboCop toy that she and her brother had growing up, and when you pressed a button on its chest, it spoke to you, addressing whoever was holding it as if they were already a criminal, so saying things like "drop it" and "your move, creep." And so she kind of takes, the poem starts out with her recounting this and then moves into a narrative about the militarization of the police and the kind of way technology now is being used by police forces to kind of track people and target specific people and target specific areas, which are all things that she's also written about. So that was, I think, maybe the piece that dealt with it most explicitly. And Last Words, of course, as well, just in terms of it, obviously, worked. You said you actually used the word reckoning when you described the piece, and I think that's actually a really apt term, just because it does kind of, you know, puts these statements, Last Words really puts these statements out there and kind of asks people to respond to them in some way. It you know, there's not a whole lot of guidance in terms of how the artist is kind of, you know, what they are expecting you to kind of think or do, but you're sort of faced with these statements that you wouldn't normally hear, in a lot of cases, assuming that you're, you know, if you're seeing the show and you're a U.S. citizen, that you're, you know, they've been executed by this government, that you, you know, in some ways you're a citizen and this is part of the government that represents you. So I think reckoning is a very apt term to use.
I want to, yeah, the whole project just sounds really fascinating. I want to talk about, I know you say that most of the curators in the, this is a really new process for you, you were mentioning, because most of you as curators had never worked much with sound art. And I know you got into a lot of details about that. I have so many other questions regarding the process, but I do want to move on and talk about the projects that you have on the horizon. Mm-hmm. Because I know you, as you said, you've been working with field projects recently, mm-hmm. which is an artist-run space in New York. I would love to talk about the projects. You mentioned that in an earlier conversation that we had that in some ways SN seems so far away because the projects that you're working on now are, you know, examining other things or you're looking at other things. So just give us a bit of what's on the horizon.
Yeah, I would love to. So the thing I'm working on in the immediate future is a project called Full Scale Exercise, which is the project I'll be showing at Artist Run in Miami. Witchfield Projects is participating in Artist Run is the exhibition of installations by Artist Run Spaces that's taking place in Miami the first week in December. It's being organized by Tiger Strikes Asteroid, which is an Artist Run space, or network really of Artist Run Spaces, as I mentioned before, here and in Philly and in Los Angeles. So that exhibition will include work by Lisa Dillon and Patrick McDonough and Barbara Polster. And there are three artists who's are working in a variety of media, a little like sculpture and installation heavy in a way, but I am really excited about the projects and the way it's gonna relate to the space that it's in and the larger context of Miami in that particular week. Mm-hmm. So a full-scale exercise, which Full Scale Exercise is the name of the project, but it refers to an emergency preparedness procedure that is carried out to prepare for sort of future emergencies. So it asks participants to prepare for something that might happen in the future by enacting the kind of behaviors and techniques they might need to use. So in a really practical sense, it really is like, you know, a local police department might have a full-scale exercise to prepare for some kind of events, or with the federal emergency management, if they might do it in terms of storm preparation, if there was going to be a tornado in your area, like what exactly would you have to do? So that's where the phrase comes from. So it kind of has this reference both to emergency preparedness, but also to this division between the real and the artificial. So the thing that always gets said about it is that it aspires to be as close to the real thing as possible. So this collapse between and the distinction between the real and the fake in a kind of, which I think Lisa Dillon's work especially speaks to. She makes these sort of sculptural objects that draw on the sort of, you know, images and connotations of prehistory and updates them. And there's a couple of specific pieces that she's done that the series of these plant objects that look extremely real but are actually not real are very finely crafted fakes. Patrick McDonough, who's another artist who's in the exhibition, has a series that he's done a few installations with tanning bed lights. So we're going to have one of those in the show, which I'm excited about. And I think all three artists also are working in ways that reference climate change and questions of the future, which is something I'm sort of interested in exploring more long term. Mm-hmm.
What artists are in this show? So you said Lisa Dillon and Patrick McDonough. Is it just those two artists?
The third artist is Barbara Polster, who's a young Washington State or Seattle-based artist.
Okay, and the exhibition is up from when to when?
It is up from December 1st through December 6th as part of Artist Run in Miami. So if you're in Miami for the art fairs,
yeah,
check it out. There's a bunch of great groups that are going to be participating as part of the show, Artist Run Spaces from all over the U.S., and I think a few that are international as well. So it should be an interesting group. I think it'll be nice to have it there as kind of a counterpoint to the really heavily commercial side of Miami, which I'm sure you can't really avoid entirely. But
right. And then you said there were other projects that you were working with at Few Projects. Was there another one that you mentioned, or am I making up?
Please? That's the main thing that I have on the main curatorial project I have on the horizon. I'm going to be working with field projects, just in terms of helping to run the space and, you know, helping to do some work on other exhibitions that some of the other people who are involved will be curating. We do have a show up right now actually called Impossible Geometries, which is work selected from an open call by a guest curator. The guest curator that we had this time around was Lauren Haynes, who's an associate curator at the Studio Museum in Harlem here in New York. So it's really, really great to work with her. Field Projects does open calls twice a year, and it's a great opportunity for us. You know, we usually have a guest curator who comes in and selects work for an exhibition from the open call, but then we also use it as an opportunity to, you know, find new artists that we might be interested in. I know they've had other artists who have participated or submitted to the open call and then had solo shows in the space. And so it's sort of just a great way for us to find new people and get exposed to a wide range of work. So we just went through that process back in October and actually late September. And then Impossible Geometries, which is work that was selected through that process by Lauren, is up through December 19th.
Mm-hmm. Where is Field Projects located?
So Field Projects is in Chelsea. It's at 526 West 26th Street in Chelsea, on the 8th floor. It's in the West Chelsea Arts Building. So it's a small space, but it's a really nice location. There are a few other galleries on our floor in the building, so it's nice to be in conversation with a lot of the other things happening. And, you know, obviously, and Chelsea is a hotbed of galleries, still some really large scale blue chip galleries, and then a lot of smaller places. And actually, the kitchen where Essen was is also still in Chelsea. So a few more experimental and nonprofit venues as well.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Well, you know, I will be consulting you on the process that you went through for the Whitney ISP, because we're for a residency program. You know, we are about to embark on an experiment where we pair local artists with international artists, and you know, one of the things that you said when you mentioned the whole process of the three of you curators mm-hmm. coming together really. That just really that was pretty significant for me, because mm-hmm. I envisioned the process being somewhat similar to that. So mm-hmm. yeah, I look forward to talking about that more.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think it was really valuable in a lot of ways. Definitely challenging, and I think for me, I sort of really early on had to you have to accept that it's a collaborative process, and it's, you're not going to put together the exhibition that any one of you would necessarily have done on your own. Mm-hmm. But I do think I got a lot out of it. And even now, I mean, with the shows I'm organizing, you know, I think there are ways it's changed how I think about curating that I'm still kind of becoming aware of. When I think back to how much it, I think it kind of impacted my ways of thinking. And it's good to have your kind of default ways of working challenged, whether or not you wind up changing them or not, or you just kind of become more firmly embedded in them. But yeah, so I think it was challenging, but definitely valuable.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being here with us, Blair. It has been a pleasure talking to you and hearing more about the projects.
Thank you for having me, and thanks so much to everyone for listening.
Yeah, thank you everybody for tuning in, and I will be sharing the archive link, so this conversation will be up on our YouTube channel for everyone to listen to. All right, good night, everybody.
Good night.
Night, Blair.